Welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edwin Willett, and this episode's guest, Casey Ezell. Welcome to another episode of The World Shapers, the podcast where I, your genial host, Edward Willett, talk to other science fiction and fantasy authors about their creative process. I am myself an author of science fiction and fantasy. My latest book is called The Moonlit World. It's book three in my World Shapers series from Daw Books. The title that ran through my head, which was Werewolves and Vampires and Peasants, Oh My, because that's the kind of story it is. In the World Shapers series, there are a series of shaped worlds, and the shapers of those worlds live inside them. It's a bit like authors living inside their own books. And in the series, my main character, Shauna Keyes, came from a world very much like ours, but she actually shaped it. And when she's chased out of that world by the adversary, who wants to take over all the worlds and eventually destroy them, she ends up going through a series of worlds, accompanied by Carl Yatzer, this mysterious stranger who showed up and explained to her what was going on, told her that her world was lost, but that she had demonstrated the power by resetting time during an attack in which her best friend was killed, which is how she discovered she had this power. That if she will come with him, he thinks that she can gather the knowledge of the making of all these worlds, get it to Agrare, and protect the labyrinth and all its people from the adversary. That was all set up in the first book, World Shaper, which takes place in a world much like ours. Book two, Master of the World, which came out last year and came out in mass market paperback just in August, is set in a world shaped by someone who really liked Jules Verne. So it's got, you know, weird airships and submarines and floating islands and strange weapons and all that kind of good old steampunky stuff. And then the new one, The Moonlit World, as I said, is Werewolves and Vampires and Peasants, Oh My, is shaped by someone who really likes werewolves and vampires. And Shauna and Carl have to make their way through this world, find the shapers, gather the knowledge of the world without getting either turned into undead creatures of the night or either turned into a lycanthrope or just eaten by one. So that's The Moonlit World. It's out now in trade paperback and ebook. The other thing that I really want to mention, though, is actually connected closely to this podcast. Back in March, I kickstarted an anthology called Shapers of Worlds, which features authors who were guests during the first year of the World Shapers podcast. And that's a pretty impressive list of authors, and 18 of them said they could take part. So the book, which is out now in ebook everywhere, you can find it on wherever you buy ebooks, and will be out in print November 17th, has new fiction from Seanan McGuire, Tanya Huff, David Weber, L.D. Modisett Jr., D.J. Butler, Christopher Rocchio, John C. Wright, Edward Willett, Shelley Adina, and reprints by John Scalzi, David Brin, Joe Haldeman, Julie Ishaneda, Fonda Lee, Dr. Charles E. Gannon, Gareth L. Powell, Derek Kunskin, and Thorea Dyer. As I said, the ebook is available everywhere. The print book will be available November 17th. You can pre-order the print book from Shadowpaw Press, which is the publisher. That's my little publishing company named after our cat, Shadowpaw. Shadowpawpress.com. You can also buy the ebook directly from shadowpawpress.com. You can also find the ebook or pre-order the print book at my own online store, edwardwillettshop.com. The print is gradually starting to show up on various sites for order, but it hasn't really settled in yet as the distributor makes that happen. But it will be out November 17th in print, and then will be available through any bookstore. So that's Shapers of Worlds. I hope that you will check it out. I'm very pleased with it and very excited that I've already talked to my authors from the second year, and many of them are interested in being in Shapers of Worlds Volume 2. People like, Barb Hambley and Kelly Armstrong and S.M. Sterling and Marie Brennan and Tim Pratt, and the list goes on and on there as well. Another great lineup of possible contributors for that. So look for another Kickstarter, probably February or March of the new year. Okay, I think that's the introductory material. Just a reminder that Shapers of Worlds is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. And now let's get on to this episode's guest, Casey Ezell. Casey Ezell is an active-duty USAF instructor pilot with 2,500-plus hours in the UH-1N Huey and Mi-171 helicopters. When not teaching young pilots to beat the air into submission, she writes sci-fi, fantasy, horror, noir, alternate history fiction. Her novels Minds of Men and The World Asunder were both Dragon Award finalists for Best Alternate History in 2018 and 2019, respectively. She's contributed to multiple BAME anthologies and has twice been selected for inclusion in the year's Best Military and Adventure Science Fiction Compilation. In 2018, her story Family Over Blood won the year's Best Military and Adventure Science Fiction Reader's Choice Award. In addition to writing for BAME Books and Blackstone Publishing, she has published several novels and short stories with independent publisher Chris Kennedy Publishing. She's married with two daughters, and you can find out more and join her mailing list at www.caseyezell.net. So, Casey, welcome to the World Shapers.
Thank you so much for having me.
I should point out that we are speaking across a vast portion of the Earth's surface, since you're in Tokyo and I'm in Regina, Saskatchewan, so... 15 hours difference, I think. So it's an early morning interview for you and a late afternoon one for me on two different days. So it really is a science fictional
the
world.
The future is now, friends.
Yeah, exactly.
It really is.
Well, I'm glad to have the chance to talk to you. You were actually, your name was suggested to me by one of your fellow BAME authors. So always glad to get recommendations from people I've talked to. We've never met in person, so... this will be a good chance to get to know you. So let's start. Let's start at the very beginning, as they say in The Sound of Music.
Indeed.
And one interesting thing is that you were born in South Dakota, so you probably actually know where Saskatchewan is. So that's nice.
I do. Vaguely. Sort of northish.
Yeah, you just go up past North Dakota, and then it's us, basically.
Yeah, right.
So let's start with, I always say this, we take you back into the mists of time, where you grew up and how you got interested in, probably you started as a reader, most of us do, and how that led you to become a writer. And also this whole bit of being in the Air Force and being a helicopter pilot, that's interesting too.
So I was born in South Dakota, but my parents, when I was about 6 years old, my parents joined the United States Air Force as well. And so we started moving around shortly after like first grade. One of the very intelligent things that my mother did, I was kind of an early reader. I started reading just before kindergarten. And then once I started reading, I very quickly devoured, you know, any written word I could get my hands on. During one of our first moves, my mom, I think desperate for me to stop whining that I was bored and didn't have any friends yet, because we had just moved, put a copy of Anne McCaffrey's Dragon Drums into my hands and said, here, this is for kids, read it. And so I read it and was immediately entranced. And that was my gateway drug to science fiction and fantasy, if you will, was the Harper Hall trilogy for Dragon Riders of Pern.
That would do
and,
it.
And yeah, it really did. And well, you know, and so here's me. I'm, you know, like, well, so I read Dragon Drums when we lived in Albuquerque. And then very shortly after that, we moved overseas to the Philippines. And during that overseas move, my mom gave me the actual Dragon Riders of Pern trilogy, the first trilogy that Anne McCaffrey wrote in that series. And and for a kid who was leaving all of her friends behind to go overseas to another country, like the idea of being a dragon rider and being telepathically paired with like your perfect companion who will always love you, who will never leave you, who you'll never have to move away from, was really enticing. And I got it into my head that I really, really wanted to be a dragon rider. And turns out dragons are in fairly short supply here on mundane Earth. So my very logical 9-year-old brain decided that I was going to be a pilot instead, because that was about as close as I was going to be able to get. So so that's when I, one, both fell in love with science fiction and fantasy, and two, decided to pursue aviation as a career. Anne McCaffrey's fault.
besides Anne McCaffrey, were there some other books that were kind of inspiring to you along the way?
Oh, absolutely. You know, like I said, I read anything I could get my hands on. You know, my mom put The Lord of the Rings. She bought me that trilogy very shortly after that, and you know, got really into Tolkien. You know, for the which was my introduction, as I think it is for most people, to, you know, the world of high fantasy. And in an odd way, you know, I pointed this out at a convention a couple years ago, but there's a connection there between like Tolkien-esque high fantasy and a lot of the military science fiction that, you know, that I read and write today. Because, you know, with epic fantasy, you're talking about these sweeping movements, but you're also a lot of times talking about armies and, you know, the movements of armies and the tactical decisions of the, you know, of their leadership and stuff. And that's part of what makes military science fiction so interesting too. So I think that kind of, in a way, laid the groundwork for my interest in that, as did my, you know, my own military career, of course, and the experiences that I had growing up in as a military brat, particularly living overseas in the Philippines, which was, you know, as I'm sure most people know, the Philippines was a hotly contested area back in the, you know, 1940s timeframe. And so the opportunity to see a lot of those historical, you know, memorials and some of the battlefield sites and things of that nature was really cool and really interesting to me as a budding history enthusiast and you know, and writer.
Well, when did you actually start trying your own hand at writing?
So my mom, somewhere in her stuff, has a notebook that I wrote like some of my first stories in when I was about 6 years old. So I was young. I started writing almost as soon as I started reading.
And did you?
Maybe that wasn't the answer to the question that you wanted. As far as like professionally, is that what you're saying?
Well, no, but how did that develop then as you went along? I mean, okay, you started when you were six, but you wrote longer and longer stuff, or did you share it with other people?
Well, yeah.
I like to ask that question because I did, but not everybody does.
I did. I shared it. You know, I would show my things to my mom, and my mother was, so my mother is a huge science fiction fantasy fan. She's a, you know, she's another voracious reader, and she's always been, you know, probably my number one first reader and fan, obviously, you know, as moms tend to do. So yeah, I would show my stories to my mom. But the other thing that I would do, and, you know, I didn't realize it at the time, but I was kind of a bossy little girl. And so when, you know, I would get my friends together, the kids together in the neighborhood or on the playground at school or wherever, a lot of times it was like, hey, let's play pretend. We're going to pretend that we're on a spaceship and you're going to be the captain and I'm going to be the pilot and you're going to do, and I would make up these play scenarios that really were just stories, you know, and I was like, okay, and now the aliens are attacking, and, you know, so
I used to do that, and my friends never really got into it the same way I did. It was kind of annoying.
No, well, mine rarely did. Sometimes it worked, you know, and sometimes we would play out, you know, a certain, I don't know, scenario for a couple days or whatever, but yeah, in a lot of ways, I think that was, while it wasn't necessarily writing things down, but it was still sort of making up stories and sharing, you know, sharing those stories with other people, trying to involve other people in my stories. So, yeah, a little bit of an extrovert. So yeah, I tend to want everyone to pay attention to me and my stories.
Well, you went into the Air Force and pilot training and all that. Mm-hmm. I would have thought that would keep you fairly busy for a while. When did you start to try to write professionally?
Well, so, yeah, so for sure the Air Force kept me very busy, but here's the thing is that, so I graduated from the Air Force Academy in 1999, and, right around that time, I discovered the magical world of AOL fandom and the Dragon Riders of Pern fandom groups that existed there. And so once again, you know, Anne McCaffrey comes to my rescue, right? So, so even though I was busy at work and busy, you know, learning to fly and things like that, one of my hobby outlets became interacting with other fans on these groups and actually writing fan fiction. And in those groups, you know, doing like, and when I say writing fan fiction, it wasn't necessarily like writing stories to, you know, be produced in like a fanzine or anything like that. It was mostly like role play by email, essentially, where, you know, I would create a Dragon Rider character and my friends would create this other one and our characters would interact via email. And it's super geeky and super nerdy. I mean, don't get me wrong. but it was an outlet and it was something that I really enjoyed, and it allowed me to, you know, to kind of play in one of my favorite worlds. And actually, you know, during the course of that, I learned a lot about, you know, things like character development and story pacing and, you know, what to do in dialogue and what not to do in dialogue, and how to keep your character's thoughts confined to their own head and not go head hopping and things like that, because you can't when someone else is controlling the other character in the scene, you know. It's considered very rude. So super geeky, but it was fun, and it allowed me to continue, you know. Tony Weisskopf, the publisher of Bane Books, she has this saying that she says all the time, that writers write because they can't help it. And I find that to be kind of true in my case, that if I'm not actually like writing stories, the stories are going to come out in some way, whether it's, you know, through playing with my friends or doing online fan fiction or whatever. It's, I'm never not writing, right? It's kind of like breathing. It's something that I have to do. So
that sounds familiar. And you don't have to talk to me about being geeky. I actually drew pictures for a Star Trek fanzine when I was in university. So I was
that's awesome, dude.
Doing pictures of Kirk and Spock, and I think I did a pretty good Spock. That's all I can remember. I can remember doing a pretty good Spock.
That's awesome. Yeah, I have zero talent when it comes to like creating visual fan art. I wish I did, because there's some gorgeous stuff out there. I would love to learn how to draw dragons, but.
Well, I minored in art.
Just never got there.
I minored in art, so it actually was a potential direction to go in. But
that's cool.
I often say that I majored in journalism because I wanted to be a writer. But really, I majored in Dungeons and Dragons, and everything else was kind of a sideline to that.
Dungeons and Dragons should be a major at school. Like
I put more time into that than I did into my schoolwork, for sure.
There's a lot that you can learn from tabletop role playing. I support that, really.
So when did you start trying to get published professionally?
So I have a confession to make, but it happened sort of by accident. So when I was in pilot training back in 2001, I discovered the amazing, mind-bending experience that is Dragon Con in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. Over Labor Day weekend.
I've been once.
And, oh my gosh. Right. Am I right though? It's mind-bending. It's like walking into, it's like being, you know, being away from home your whole life and then walking through the doors of the hotel, and suddenly you're on your home planet with your people. Everybody's geeky. Everybody's into the things you're into. And if they're not, it's just because they don't know about it yet. And yeah, I love it. Dragon Con is, it's always the highlight of my year. But my first one was in 2001 because I'm super old. And after that, I went back several other times. And so in 2004, I think, was the next one that I attended. And in 2004, I had the opportunity to meet a guy by the name of John Ringo, who I didn't know this at the time. I hadn't read any of his work before meeting him, but he was a New York Times bestselling military science fiction author, also published by Bane Books, still is, as a matter of fact. And talking with him, you know, he's into MilSci, yeah, that's his genre, and so, you know, we were talking about flying and about, you know, fandom and being geeks in the military and things like that. And he struck up a friendship with our group of friends that we were all there together. We maintained an email correspondence, and I saw him at conventions, you know, a couple years after that. And then when I was deployed to Iraq in 2009, he emailed me and said, "Hey, I'm doing this, you know, I got asked to do this project. I'm editing this anthology of military science fiction by military veterans. And I want to include some new voices along with some of the, you know, the reprints that we've done and things like that. And I know, you know, I know you just finished. So the Air Force made me get a degree, a master's degree, and but they didn't specify what it had to be in. So I was like, all right, well, I'm going to get an MFA in writing because screw you guys, I can do what I want. So John knew that I just finished that just, you know, because I'd been like, hey, guess what? I'm done with my master's. Hooray. And he was like, I know you just got a, you know, your writing degree. Do you have anything that you'd like to submit? And I said, no, but I could. Give me 24 hours. And so I wrote a story very quickly. But when you're deployed, there's very little to do. You really, like, you go to work, you fly, you go to the gym, you eat, and the rest of it is just kind of hanging out time, right? And so I just took that hanging out time and knocked out this story. And it wasn't very long. I think it was only like 5,000 words or something like that. But it was a cute little story. And I sent it in, and it became part of the anthology. You know, they accepted it for the anthology. And so that was my first publication. And then after that, Jim Mintz, a couple years later, once I was back in the States, and again, back at Dragon Con, Jim Mintz, you know, who also had, he was one of the editors on the project as well, came up to me and he was like, so when are you going to have a novel for me? I've been waiting for it for a couple of years. And I was like, oh, well, let me get on that. So that was really the start of my career is I started doing, writing short stories for anthologies. Again, mostly connected with John Ringo, and he kind of like pulled me in, and then I started, you know, branching out from there. Yeah.
Before we go on to what you started writing, at that point, I'm interested in the MFA because I've talked to other authors who have had, you know, that sort of formal creative writing training, right. And I get mixed reviews on how helpful it actually was. Was it helpful in your case? Did you find it very worthwhile?
So aspects of it were helpful. Not necessarily from a standpoint of like professional connections or anything like that. But so, like I said, the Air Force was going to make me get a master's degree and they were going to pay for it. And they didn't really care what it was in. It was just kind of almost like a box to be checked. So I decided to do something, you know, knowing myself the way that I do, I really only want to spend energy and time on things that are interesting to me. And I knew that I wouldn't, you know, if I tried to get like a aviation management degree, there would be aspects of it that were interesting, but there would be other aspects of it that would be deadly dull and that I would probably procrastinate and, you know, potentially not do very well on. So instead I chose to pursue the MFA in creative writing.
Where did you get
that? I also chose from National University. It's a primarily online university that caters to a lot of military folks. Mm-hmm. I think they're based out of San Diego. So you know, not a real big well known name in academia or anything like that. But the program itself, I really enjoyed. I found it to be, you know, because I think what I was trying to get out of it was, one, just the piece of paper that said I had a master's degree that the Air Force required. But two, I was just trying to have an enjoyable experience and kind of expand my toolbox, if you will. My concentration was in poetry, not in short fiction. I guess you could kind of do a long fiction concentration, but I chose poetry in part because I've always loved poetry. I've written it almost as long as I've written stories. And I find that that a lot of the tips and techniques and, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Just the things that you do that make poetry can really inform your prose writing and really help to make it beautiful. And so I So that's why, well, and also poems are shorter. So again, less, typically, not always, sometimes they're super long, but the graduation requirements were definitely shorter. Rather than writing a novel, I only had to write a chapbook of 50 poems for to complete my program. So that was a pretty big draw too. Yeah, you know, when you're active duty military and at the time a single mom, I was trying to balance out my requirements, and that was my strategic decision. But I did. I loved it. Not because it necessarily got me anywhere in the publishing business, but for my own personal development, it taught me how to critique. It taught me how to take critique. And that's probably the two most immediately valuable lessons that I learned from that program, is how to give constructive critique that is actually useful to the other individual, and how to receive critique and to tell what's constructive and what's just, oh, I loved it, it's great, you should write more, you know, stuff like that. Not that there's anything wrong with those kind of comments. We love those kind of comments, but they don't necessarily help develop you as a writer.
Yeah, it's like my mom didn't read my stuff, but my dad would, and he'd say it was great and okay, but I need a little more than that to make it better in the future. Yeah. So.
Right. Right.
It was your poetry that you were writing. Did it have any fantastical element to it, or was it more straightforward?
Some
poetry?
Did. Yeah, some did. So, what I mostly wrote for the program, was actually aviation related, because that, I was the only pilot in my, group that was going through the program at the time. And so, you know, write what you know, right? But also not only write what you know, but write about what makes you different and what makes you unique. And that's sort of, you know, find that niche, that brand. Yeah, I ended up writing a lot of poetry about, I'm just thinking of my chapbook collection now. You know, a lot of it has to do with flying and, you know, being in the Air Force and, you know, what it's like to fly in the daytime, at nighttime, stuff like that. So, yeah.
This has nothing to do with writing, but what drew you to helicopters as opposed to,
they
say, fixed
fun.
Wing? They're more fun?
They seemed more fun, yeah. Yeah, no, I before I went to pilot training, when I was what's called a casual lieutenant, I had already graduated from the Air Force Academy and been commissioned, but I was awaiting my pilot training start date. I had the opportunity to ride on a MH-53 helicopter. It's what the Air Force used to use for special operations. They've since retired that airframe. I remember sitting on the back. So it had like a ramp on the back, and it had a 50 caliber machine gun mounted on that ramp. And we were out flying over a range, and I didn't actually get to shoot that day, which made me very sad, but I did get to sit on the ramp next to the gunner. You know, he was sitting on one side and I was of the weapon, and I was sitting on the other side, and, you know, kicking my feet off the back of the ramp while we're flying 50 feet above the ground. And it was pretty cool. I was like, yeah, this is a lot of fun. I'm gonna do this.
Was it at least some of the feeling of flying in a dragon, do you think? Flying on a dragon?
Yeah, maybe. Although we were, not necessarily that particular experience, because we were going backwards.
No.
Because I was sitting out the back. but sometimes, yeah, sometimes it has, you know, when you can feel, the thing about flying helicopters versus flying fixed wing is that, you know, flying fixed wing is about 50% art, 50% science, right? But flying helicopters it's more like 70-30 art versus science. And the reason is because you do so much more of it, at least my helicopter. Now, I fly a UH-1 Huey, which, you know, was the quintessential Vietnam era helicopter, if that tells you anything. Every tail number that I fly was made in 1969. So they are old birds. And we're not talking cutting edge technology in any sense of the word. And so because of that, in part because of that, so much of what we do is, it's all seat of the pants, muscle memory. Like it has to feel right. And that, you know, when we're teaching young aviators, half of what we're teaching is just getting them to practice the maneuvers to the point where they can feel what feels right versus what feels wrong. And And so I think that when you, you know, occasionally when you do a particular maneuver, and it feels just right, I think that it must be very similar to what that would feel like, you know, on the back of your own dragon to whom you were telepathically linked.
I've been sitting here trying to remember. I had characters in a helicopter in a book two or three books ago in my current series. And so I was researching helicopters because I'm not exactly an expert on the subject. And I went down a rabbit hole where I was reading helicopter jokes for about half an hour. And unfortunately,
there's a ton of them.
I can't remember any of them off the top of my head. I was going to try one on you. But
yeah. Well, beating the air. We don't fly. We beat the air into submission. That's a very common one. We don't fly. We're so ugly. The earth repels us. That's
I remember that one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there's a ton of helicopter jokes. And what's so funny is that, you know, like a lot of professions that, you know, have jokes about us, we tend to embrace those things. And helicopter air crews as a whole, we have a reputation for being a little bit crazy. And what's very interesting about that is that there's some science to actually back that up. If you, if you put our personality traits, and by our, I mean society's personality traits on a bell curve, helicopter air crews are highly skewed to one end when it comes to traits of like aggressiveness and, the adrenaline junkiness, whatever the proper term for that is. So there's some data to back up the fact that we're all crazy. Well, or you could just meet one of us and know that.
Well, like taking us back to the writing side of things. So,
sure.
So Jim Minns had suggested a novel to you, but was your first novel Minds of Men? Is that then your first novel? But that's not a Bane book.
Yeah. No. No. So, not for lack of trying, it wasn't. So my first actual novel contract was with Bane, and it was for Gunpowder and Embers, which was a collaboration that I did with John Ringo and Christopher L. Smith, that just came out last January. While we were working on Gunpowder, and it was we'd finished up the first draft and it was in edits and development. I had this other idea to write a story about World War II aviation, but with female psychics on board. And
as one does.
Right. Well, so what got me thinking about it was, you know, I was thinking about how air crew are kind of a different, you know, like a lot of subcultures, I'll say, you know, we end up being kind of a different breed and having a our own discrete ways of communicating with one another. And I kind of got to thinking about that. And then the other thing that happened was that we had an air show and I had the opportunity to see the inside of a B-17 cockpit. And I'm used to flying with a relatively primitive aircraft, but I got nothing on those guys, man. I have no idea how they even navigated. I mean, it's no wonder that they had an entire crew member whose sole job was to do navigation, because their navigation, you know, their tools that they had to use were so primitive. And to think that they took 100 ship formations of this incredibly primitive aircraft, not just into the weather, but into the weather out the other side, and then flew them in combat, was like mind-boggling. I mean, just the amount of courage of those men who did that was, you know, it was flabbergasting when it dawned on me the magnitude of the task that they had accomplished and done so over and over and over again. You know, their loss rates were just staggering. And so I started thinking about that. And the reason I came up with the psychics was that one of the things that could potentially compensate for, you know, in a way that we have compensated with technology would be, you know, the instantaneous communication that a telepathic connection might provide. I got to thinking about that and decided to write a story. It became Minds of Men. And I did actually send it to Toni at Bane, and she sent it back saying, you know, this is not for us. It's not for, you know, it's not the kind of thing that I think our readership would snap up. However, she sent me some very, very valuable critique, and I will be forever grateful to her for that time and attention that she took to actually provide that for me instead of just saying no thanks. And so I took it and applied the critique, and I had recently been approached by Chris Kennedy of Chris Kennedy Publishing to do a novel in his and Mark Wandry's military science fiction shared world called the Four Horsemen universe. So I decided to ring him up, I guess, and say, hey, you know, would you be interested in looking at this? He said, yeah, send it on over. And the thing about Chris is that he's an aviator too, right? So, so I think I spoke to my audience there with that one. But yeah, he loved it. And I published it, under Chris Kennedy's, Theogony imprint. And that was kind of the start of that Psyche of War series.
Well, we'll take a closer look at that one as an example of your creative process. I did want to mention that I also had an opportunity to tour the inside of a B-17. One came to our local airport a couple of years ago, and my experience there, which I never thought I would have, was that this horrendous thunderstorm blew in, and we were all kind of stuck out there in the tarmac, and I'm standing under the wing of an all-aluminum airplane while lightning is cracking around and the rain's pouring down, and I'm thinking, I'm not sure this is the best place we could be at this moment. I have video of it somewhere. My daughter was with me, and she was quite concerned, and I wasn't terribly happy myself. Oh, but the other thing I wanted to mention about navigation was that my grandfather-in-law, was a First World War navigator on a Handley Page bomber. These things had 80-foot wingspans. They were enormous. But you talk about your primitive navigation. It was mostly mm-hmm. – we actually have his notebook from when he was at navigation school, and he was like one of the top-ranking students when he was in navigation school in the Royal Air Force. A lot of it went down to, do you recognize that church steeple over there in the horizon?
Right.
That's the target, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, right. It was interesting.
So by the time World War II had rolled around, they had very, very basic radio navigation available. But what they would do is they would call on the radio to a station and get a ping. And then the navigator would plot the information that they got from that ping and then just triangulate their position from there. And then they used a lot of dead reckoning, which, you know, that's just following, you know, flying this direction over the map for a given period of time should put us here if we maintain a constant speed. It was insane, man.
I always found the word...
I'll take my GPS. Thank you very much.
I always found the word dead and dead reckoning to be a little alarming. But
yeah, it's slightly ominous for sure, especially when we're talking about dead reckoning into combat, right?
Yeah. So you sort of talked about where the idea for... Minds of Men came from, and you gave a hint of it, but do you want to give a bit more of a synopsis of it, and then we'll talk about your writing process?
Sure, yeah. So the synopsis of Minds of Men is essentially it's 1943, and 8th Air Force bombers are flying out of England, and they're just getting their lunch eaten by the Luftwaffe fighters because they didn't have a long-range fighter escort that had the capability to take them all the way to their target and back. So they were particularly vulnerable during part of their sortie. And their loss rates were just incredible and staggering if you actually go and read those numbers and think about, you know, how many men that represents. And in this, like I said, in this world, some women, and they're all women because I'm sexist, but some women have the ability to create psychic connections with other people and communicate with them telepathically. And one of these 8th Air Force generals knows about it because his wife is one of these women. So they end up, you know, doing a super secret recruiting drive essentially and come up with 20 women powerful enough to do this job who end up flying with these bomber crews out of England, helping them to maintain closer formation, better formation integrity, helping them to respond quicker to, you know, threats and things like that. And that ups their success rate. but at what kind of cost, right? Because now these women are not only experiencing the hell of warfare for themselves, but they're experiencing it tenfold because they're experiencing it through the minds of each of their crew members too. And then, of course, as is every air crew member's nightmare, you know, at some point the main character gets shot down, and so now she's stuck in occupied Europe, you know, with her surviving crew, or trying to find her surviving crew members from the crash, and they're having to escape and evade their way through occupied Europe, all while being chased by, because it turns out that the Germans have psychics too. So there's a team of German Fallschirmjäger and a psychic woman who is pursuing them. The latter half of the book was actually a lot of fun to write. Well, the whole thing was pretty fun to write, but I really enjoyed doing the research for the latter half of the book because I really got to dig into some of the stories about resistance-led escape lines that ran throughout Europe in the Second World War. And these were organizations that would help not just Allied airmen, but they actually started really helping to repatriate soldiers stranded by the evacuation of Europe, ones who couldn't get out at Dunkirk, essentially. And at least that's when one of the Belgian lines that I researched started. And they would smuggle these Allied airmen and soldiers through the Nazi lines and take them on trains and try to get them get them out to sea to get picked up by usually Royal Navy destroyers or over the Pyrenees into ostensibly neutral Spain and get them picked up at the British embassy there. So really fascinating stuff. And it was a lot of fun to write, to kind of combine those stories and put it in my own.
Well, so what that kind of brings me around to the next question. Well, first of all, you said, as a helicopter pilot, kind of a seat of the pants flyer. Are you also a seat of the pants writer, or are you a detailed outliner?
So that aspect of my styles is sort of evolving, honestly. And I do a lot of collaboration, and I find that when working with another author, a detailed outline is actually really helpful because it allows you to say, okay, well, I'm going to go away and I'm going to work on this part of the outline and I'm going to bring it back and here it is. And then, you can just get more done that way if you agree ahead of time where you're going with the story so you don't have, surprises. For myself, I would say that I'm an outliner, but I outline in phases. I don't do the whole thing right up front. I'll write like the outline of the first act, and then I'll write the first act and kind of see how it's going. And then I'll figure out, okay, where am I going to go in the second act? And so I kind of do it in chunks, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
And once you have the outline, what's your actual writing process? Do you write, with a quill pen under a tree or?
No, I use my laptop.
I mean, being a poet, never know.
Right. Yeah. I use my laptop. I enjoy Scrivener. It's a program.
Yeah. I have it and haven't climbed the learning curve yet to use it, but I have it.
It is steep. The learning curve is steep. I got it and I went ahead and said, okay, I paid for this program. I'm going to learn how to use it. And I dedicated 2 days and just went through the tutorials, and it took that long, but I'm glad that I did it because, it walked me through all of the functionality, and I've since forgotten a lot of it because I don't, it's a very, very capable program, and I don't use, I probably only use about 2/3 of what it's actually able to do. But yeah, I like it a lot. I like the flexibility that it gives me to move things around and kind of see, okay, this is where this is, and, link characters to different things and stuff. So yeah. So yeah, I use Scrivener, and then
you write sequentially.
So with most of the time I have to. When I don't, it's usually because I'm dead stuck and I gotta skip a part and go on and then come back and fill it in. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, I write sequentially. The challenge for me is always, like I think it is for many people, you know, who have day jobs and families and stuff, is always finding that balance to, you know, time to dedicate to sit down and do the writing. And not just the time, but the energy, you know, because I could for sure sit down every night at 10 o'clock and write for an hour. But by that time, a lot of times I'm so exhausted that I, you know, what would be the point, right? I don't know that I'd get anything useful out of it.
Yeah, it does. It does take energy to write. I'm not, you know, people think you just sit there and type, but it actually takes a lot of energy to write.
Right, right. It, you know, and it's the mental energy, which is, you know, the kind that like just gets sucked out of you if you have a boring day at work or whatever. So for me, what I've found is that I have to have a very low but consistent daily word count goal, and I have to keep that habit up of writing. So I don't even know if it's the goal, but my minimum is that every day, even no matter how exhausted I am, I need to sit down and write 100 words, just 100 words. And if I get to 100 words and I'm exhausted and I want to quit, I'll allow myself to quit and just say, okay, this was a low word day. But just like with, I actually heard of this technique in regards to exercise, actually, where people are like, oh, I don't really want to go to exercise, but let me get on the bike for 10 minutes. And after 10 minutes, if I want to quit, I let myself quit. But most of the time, by the time you're 10 minutes in, or in case of writing, by the time you're 100 words in, you know, there's more going on in your head and there's more that's ready to come out. And so you end up getting a little bit more than that, at least. So, my productivity has definitely fallen off this year. I think a lot of us who write, that's been the case. At least, you know, among people that I've talked to, that's been the case. And using this technique of forgiving myself and just being like, all right, you know, I'm going to keep, as long as I'm moving forward, forward progress is forward progress. We're not going to harp on how much forward progress we're getting, you know. So
once you have a draft,
it's been working for me.
Once you have a draft, what does your revision process look like?
So I do the thing that most people say you shouldn't do, and I edit as I go. But I do that because I can't. It just bothers me. It bothers me to not do it. So I do. I edit as I go. So once I have a draft, it's usually fairly clean. I will read through it one more time out loud because I find that helps me catch typos, and more importantly, it helps me catch repeated words that I, you know, use too often.
Yeah, reading out loud is a great way to find things.
Yeah,
and
better
to find it while you're writing it than when you're doing a public reading later, which is when I usually find those things.
Right,
oh,
right.
I wish I changed that before it went into print.
Ah, that's not what I said. but yeah, and that was another tip from Tony Weisskopf from Bade Books. So was read it out loud and listen to how it flows and how it sounds and stuff. So I will I'll read through the draft out loud, front to start to finish, and make any changes that I find need making there. And then from there, I usually send it off to the editor and let the editor, you know, take a look. And
so you don't have any beta readers or anything like that?
Well, no, that's not true. I do. It depends on the project, right? Mm-hmm. So, and again, a lot of times, you know, other than the Psyche of War series, all of my novels have been collaborations. So, you know, a lot of times I will bounce I'll go through it and then my co-author will go through it is what I'm trying to say. And sometimes we have beta readers, but sometimes, you know, like I said, it just goes straight to the editor. A lot of times lately we've been working right up to the deadline. So not the best practice, but
it's an extremely common one, let me tell you.
So,
Go ahead.
I was going to say for Gunpowder, we had beta readers. For Second Chance Angel, we had beta readers. So I had some beta readers for Minds of Men. I didn't for World Asunder because I was late on it. So I was like, all right, get it done. Make sure it's clean. Send it to the editor.
What kind of editorial feedback do you get back typically?
again, you know, it varies. For Second Chance Angel, Griffin and I had the wonderful experience of working with. I'm gonna not remember her last name. Our editor Betsy, she's a fantastic editor who's been in the business for years and years, and she worked with us on a developmental edit level, and so with her, you know, we sent her the draft, and she came back. And it was very much a conversation kind of modality, I guess, you know, where it was like, all right, so, you know, I have questions about this. What if you did this to this part? Or what would you think about this? Or this part threw me out, you know, of the story. How can you make this? How can you tie this back in? And she had some, you know, one of the best suggestions she gave us was, so Second Chance Angel is a like post-war, post-galactic war story. And Betsy came back and she said, look, I think that what you really need to do is sit and make a timeline of the war so that you have it very clear on how all of these things, you know, kind of came to be. It doesn't necessarily have to be included in the text, but you guys need to know it. And, you know, things like that on the developmental level. Some of my work, when I get edits back, it's really just like copy edit level stuff. I find that I get that. So like with my Psyche of War series, because it's alternate history, I don't have to do a lot of world building because it's our world. There's just psychics in it. Right. Mm-hmm. So I find that the more, maybe I'm just weak in world building, but the more world building I have to do, the more like developmental edit type feedback I get. Whereas when there's not that much world building to do, it's really more on the copy edit level, if that makes sense.
Well, you've talked
and about, I'm happy to have it both.
You're talking a little bit about Second Chance Angel, and that's the other one we want to mention. I'm actually talking to your co-author, Griffin, next.
Yes.
Actually, this week, as we're speaking, in just a few days, I'll be talking to him too. So,
good.
Maybe
he's a riot. You're going to have a good time.
Maybe a quick synopsis of that one, and then we'll talk about it a little bit.
Okay. So Second Chance Angel is a sci-fi noir thriller that Griffin Barber and I co-wrote together. And it is the story, like I said, it's a story set in the aftermath of a great galactic war, where humans essentially joined this war on the side of this alien race, this kind of mysterious alien race that we call the Mentors. And one of the ways that the Mentors enticed humanity to come into the war on their side was by offering these cybernetic upgrades that require artificial intelligence to run the upgrades or to maintain the modifications. And so they have these AIs that were written as personal AIs and that inhabit the body with the person. And it should kind of just be transparent, but one of our characters is actually one of these AIs that we call angels. And so Ralston Muck is a down on his luck veteran bouncer who's had his angel removed.
Because that's a great name, by the way, Ralston Muck.
Yeah, that was Griffin's idea. It was very noir.
Yes, very.
So he finds himself, you know, mixed up in when, you know, when a singer at the club that he works at disappears, and he finds himself in a position of having to go look for her and having to work with her personal AI to go find her. You know, they kind of slip into uncover some seedy underworld stuff, as you know, as noir stories do. And yeah, so that's sort of the synopsis of the book, is that they're trying to find Siren. And
oddly enough, I just watched Chinatown last night. You know, it's only been out for what, coming up on 50 years, and I've never watched it. So
I know. Well, but such a great movie. Yeah, I love the noir subgenre. And Second Chance Angel, for both Griffin and I, is sort of our love letter to the noir subgenre. We a couple years back, when I really got into it, I was reading a lot of Raymond Chandler. And I fell in love with the way that guy could turn a phrase, you know, and And the way that he would create these characters and make them, you know, just real people, just by the words that they would say and the comparisons that they would draw, you know. And so, yeah, I love it. I love the aesthetics of it. And so does Griffin. And so we decided to write a book and make it noir.
How did you do that? Did you write like one chapter, alternating chapters, or exactly how did that work?
Kinda, yeah. So in the book, we have essentially three points of view represented. One of the noir tropes is that, you know, you have this first person point of view narration, which is it has its advantages and it has its disadvantages. One of the advantages is that you can really do some cool, like, unreliable narrator type stuff that way, right? And we did do some of that. But one of the disadvantages is that it's by necessity a very tight POV. You know, there's only so much that you can do. So what we did was we had both Angel and Muck in first person POV, and I essentially wrote Angel's point of view and Griffin wrote Muck's. And there was some overlap and sometimes where we did one or the other, but for the most part, that's how it came about. And then kind of to address that disadvantage, you know, we realized that there was another dimension to the story that we needed to tell. And so we did that through some of the additional AIs that are not necessarily personal augmentation AIs like Angel, but that, like, the AI that is running the admin for the space station, and the AI that is the law enforcement officer AI. We rolled them in and used them to tell part of the story too from a third person point of view perspective. So,
well, it sounds quite fascinating.
And yeah, it was fun. It kind of came about organically. You know, we didn't sit down and say, okay, you're going to do this and you're going to do this. It was just sort of like, well, here, let me see. Well, I think this is how Angel would react. And I was like, oh, okay, well, this is what Muck would do next. And just sort of went from there.
Well, getting close to the end of the time here, so time to turn my attention to the big philosophical question, which is...
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, exactly. Why? Why? Why do this? Why write? Why do you write? Why do you think anybody writes? Why do we tell stories? And why specifically stories of science fiction and fantasy?
Well, those are a lot of questions. why? So
I like to
I
pretend
write?
It's just one, but it's actually more than one.
Yeah, really. So the reason that I write like I breathe, right? You know, I kind of alluded to this earlier when I was talking about being a little kid, and I've never not made up stories. I don't know how to process life without making up stories. And I think that that's on some level true for us as a human race. We are in so many ways defined by our stories, the stories that we tell, the stories that we remember, what we choose to remember, what we choose to forget. I think that stories are an essential part of the human experience. And because, you know, I don't know you and you don't know me, but I can tell you a story that is similar to something that you've experienced. And that then becomes a point of connection between us. And I think that that's something that is very important for us as humans to do, is to connect with one another, you know? So I think that I think we write for all of those reasons, you know, because that's part of what makes us who we are.
Why stories of the fantastic?
Because that also makes us part of who we are, because we, you know, we have the amazing ability to not just talk about what is, but what could be, and to get excited about what could be, and to inspire ourselves and each other. And so I think that, you know, there's great joy to be had there, in telling stories of the fantastic, whether it be in science fiction or in fantasy or even in, you know, even in the darker stuff, like the horror and the noir and, you know, they're two very different things, but they're all ways of processing this experience, right? So, you know, it's like dark humor, for example. I've been in the military for 20 years, and I have a very dark sense of humor, and most of my friends have a very dark sense of humor. And, you know, the same is true of, you know, first responders who, you know, work where they see terrible things all the time. Police officers who have to deal with, you know, domestic violence, and social workers who have to, you know, go into these situations and stuff. One of the major coping mechanisms for all of this is dark humor, is the ability to laugh so that you don't cry. And I think that, you know, there's so much out there that frightens us as humans. Even you want to talk even on an evolutionary level, like we're not the biggest, baddest animal out there. We don't have super sharp teeth. There's super sharp claws. We can't see in the dark. But what we do have is our mind and our imagination. And we have this, like I said, this ability to tell stories and this ability to inspire each other and this ability to think beyond what is, to see what could be. And that is our great evolutionary advantage. And so, you know, even taking something that's dark and turning it into our own story, you know, telling a story about it makes it a little bit more accessible. And it gives us the ability to process the emotions that come with fear a little bit better. If that, I don't know if any of that made sense.
Yeah, it made sense to me.
Okay, good.
And what, good, I'm glad. What are you working on now?
So Griffin and I we have started the sequel to Second Chance Angel, which Second Chance Angel releases, if you don't mind me saying this, Second Chance Angel releases on the 8th of September, which is today for me while we're recording this. I'm not sure when this will go up, but here in Japan, it's already release day. So yay, happy release day.
It will have been out for some time before this goes live, but that's
good. Well, good. You guys can just be part of my retroactive celebration. Yeah, so we've started the sequel, which is called The Third Sin, we're about three chapters into that. I'm also working on the third book in my Psyche of War series, which is a story set in the Vietnam era, working on sequel to Gunpowder and Embers, started outlining that, and a couple of short stories and stuff, so I've got a lot of projects.
And where can people find you online? I mentioned the website off the top. Okay. Oh, I should say that's Casey.
Yeah, so
better spell that.
So my website is www.kaceyezell.net. That's sort of the hub for where you can find me. You can go there and find lists of all my books, all my social media links, and join my mailing list, actually. And if you do that, you get like two free stories. So there's that as well, if you're into that sort of thing. But also I'm available on Instagram at Casey Ezell, and then Facebook on Casey Ezell too. So that's kind of usually where I'm most interactive on social media is Instagram and Facebook.
Okay, great. Well, thanks so much for being on The World Shapers. I enjoyed that. I hope you did too.
I did. Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun to talk to you.
And it was really fun for me to talk to Casey, too. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. That's it for this week. Just a reminder that The World Shapers is online at theworldshapers.com. Among other things there, you can find full transcripts of most episodes. I've missed a few because of time pressure, but most of them have full transcripts. And at some point, I hope to go back and catch up with those that I missed. You can also find a complete archive of all previous episodes, so check out any that you might have missed if you're just discovering the World Shapers podcast for the first time. You can find The World Shapers on Twitter at The World Shapers and on Facebook at The World Shapers. You can find me online at edwardwillett.com. You can also find me on Twitter at ewillett, and you can find me on Facebook at edward.willett and on Instagram at edwardwillettauthor. A couple other websites to mention. I mentioned Shapers of Worlds, the anthology that features fiction from some of the wonderful authors I had on this podcast during the first year, a mixture of original and reprint fiction. That's available in ebook everywhere right now. But one of the places you can get it is through Shadowpaw Press, which is my publishing company. You can find Shadowpaw Press at shadowpawpress.com. You can buy the ebook directly there and pre-order the print book, which will be out November 17th. You can do the same from my own shop, edwardwilletshop.com, where you can also get some other books and get autographed copies from me if you so desire. The other couple of websites I sometimes forget to mention, but always like to when I think of them, ecblake.com. That's one of my pseudonyms. E.C. Blake wrote the Masks of Agrima trilogy, and it has a whole website dedicated to it. And the other one I like to mention is shardsofexcalibur.com. This is my young adult fantasy series, modern day fantasy series with an Arthurian theme. The first book in it was longlisted for a Sunburst Award. Two of the other books were shortlisted for Aurora Awards. It's, I like to think, an excellent series, and I recently put it out in brand new ebook editions after the original publisher went bankrupt and I got the rights. Shadowpaw Press has put out brand new ebook editions, so you can find those at shadowpawpress.com or anywhere that ebooks are sold, and there'll be new print versions of those eventually when I get a minute. I think that's just about everything I have to mention, except to say once again that the World Shapers podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. And now I will let you go, but just urge you to come back for some of the wonderful guests I have lined up. People like F. Paul Wilson, James Morrow, Cory Doctorow, those are all in the not too distant future, and there are many more as well. And also to urge you to go to the website, theworldshapers.com, and catch up on the ones you might have missed. It's been a wonderful journey thus far, talking to all these amazing authors, finding out more about how they shape the wonderful worlds in which we have had so many adventures over the years, and the memorable characters that inhabit those worlds. That's it for this time on The World Shapers. I will talk to you again soon. Bye for now.